Imagine if it was your child. How would you feel? Imagine if it was your son on the ground screaming, I can't breathe. Help me. Please. If it was you, what would you want somebody to do? Would you want the community to come stand up with you? Or would you want them to go home and go to sleep?
In Minneapolis, the memorial site still lives where George Floyd died after a white police officer held him down with a knee to the neck. Now the protesters' calls for change are being heard. On Friday, in a virtual meeting, the city council voted to ban the use of neck restraints. They're also requiring officers who witness unauthorized use of force to report it from the scene and intervene verbally and physically.
I will say that George Floyd's death weighs heavily on me, and I know every elected official in Minneapolis. We could have done more, and we should have done more.
The protesters have asked for the police department to be defunded.
Yes.
Do you think that should happen?
I have long supported shifting funds away from our police department into community-based strategies. I think our police department needs dramatic structural change and that we need a whole new way of doing public safety in our city.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, as well as the in-house casting director for Brave New Films, which is a production company that only produces media that champions social justice issues.
And with us today, we have a very special guest.
I'm Douglas Flo, assistant professor of history at Washington University in St. Louis.
Dr. Flo, welcome.
Very happy to be here with you today.
Laura wishes she could be here. Unfortunately, she's in the UK actually working on very important legislation and training. So she was unable to get the time to do this at the last minute because we did put this together at the last minute. But again, she totally appreciates you coming on board just like we do.
Absolutely. And she really felt it was important also that we kind of interrupt our normal programming, which, as our listeners know, we usually record several podcasts in a row. So we drop them throughout the month. But I mean, we all agreed that we needed to push those aside because of this, just the stunning events that are going on in our country that are just really shaking everybody to their core as they should.
Absolutely. And I have to say that I have actually known Dr. Flo since he was about, I believe, 8 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe even earlier, yeah.
Maybe even earlier. And so we have been lifelong friends, and I am so happy that you were able to cull through all of your recent media requests and actually come on with us today, because we feel that on Real Crime Profile, we really want to continue to address the racial injustice of African Americans in this country.
This is a very important and emerging moment. So I am happy that you all are willing to take the time to do this, and I'm thankful to be here.
Well, thank you. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the work that you've done?
I teach African American history, urban history, criminality, and masculinity at Washington University. I arrived at WashU the same weekend that Michael Brown was killed, back in August of 2014. And so I came to the university, and immediately I was thrust into a number of conversations on and off campus about what had happened. And so that gave me the insight, especially seeing all of the students on campus who were so interested in trying to understand how they could contribute to or be a part of the response, and also wanting to understand the subject further, gave me the idea to design a course called The Politics of Black Criminality and Popular Protest. And that course has been running since 2015. And so just to kind of contextualize the work that I do, that course is about attempting to understand the cultural, the social, the economic, and the political components of the issue of quote-unquote Black criminality, right? How do we understand what sorts of social and historical factors have created a situation where, in my book, I argue that criminality ends up becoming resistance for people against whom the arc of justice is bent, right? And mm-hmm. so that's the crux of my work. How do we understand that? More specifically, I look at African-American men. There have been a number of really great works on the crime or the interactions of African-American women with the legal system. Just to name a few, there's Kali Gross's book, Colored Amazons, which was a huge inspiration for me to start doing this work when I was in graduate school. There's also Cheryl Hicks's Talk With You Like a Woman, which is about Black women in New York City. But no one has written a book about Black men in criminality and how certain aspects of America's past have affected them and their ideas of masculinity and how it has affected them as men and what that might produce, right? How do certain aspects of our society produce certain behaviors specific and unique to Black men that have either been termed criminal, and maybe some of those things are actually legal when others do them, or that are actually criminal? What is it that's happening? How do we understand that? How do we disentangle these factors and these historical factors and then use them to think about the present? That's my work overall.
Mm. Wow, that's awesome. That's, and obviously incredibly relevant to everything that's happening today and hopefully everything that's happening into the future. I listened recently to a TEDx talk by Megan Ming Francis, in which she also addresses issues similar to this, in which she says basically that African-American males in particular are looked at as a substitute, a proxy for criminality. In other words, there is an underlying presumption that African-American males are more prone to and actually embody criminality, which is why then police officers who encounter them in situations actually end up killing them three times more often than white males get killed in police interactions. And also that a Black man is 33% more likely to be killed while unarmed by a police officer than a white man is. And it strikes me, and especially over these last few weeks, having sort of focused on this, particularly since Ahmaud Arbery was killed, that I've seen instance after instance after instance, and I've discovered cases that I didn't know about because they weren't covered in the popular media, where Black males, even complying with police officer commands, are killed. And it seems to me that the officer is scared to death mm-hmm. of this man, even though that man could be a completely legal, completely legitimate, completely compliant person, but the difference is he's African American.
I think we sometimes have a difficult time understanding why history is so important. Sometimes people see history books and historical work as just a bunch of stories. For me, history is the only way that we can do to society the thing that we very often individually do for ourselves, right? We go to a therapist's office, and what does a therapist do? The therapist asks you about your past. And through your past, through the prism of your past, you should be able to understand the present and possibly your future. The only way to really truthfully understand the issues that you just mentioned is to look at the past. Late 19th century understanding of criminality was extremely racial when people were talking about African Americans, but it was viewed in terms of class when they talked about whites. So the understanding was that there were whites and white immigrants that were living in squalor and dealing with different types of economic deprivation that might produce their criminality. But when looking at African Americans, the idea was that race was producing criminality. There were a lot of pseudoscientific ideas, eugenic ideas that attached race, that attached certain physical features like the type of hair that one has, the shape of one's nose, and the color of their skin, that literally were seen as affecting one's behavior. And so when we think about those things and how historically they have been attached to criminality, particularly outside of slavery, during slavery, it was less necessary to come up with these sorts of theories, although these theories did exist. But there was the plantation mostly that was used as a criminal justice system for African Americans. Off of the plantation, all of these new justifications for different types of legal controls needed to be made, and the physicality was of a person was used in to that end. So African-American men ended up becoming the most feared boogeyman in American culture, because those were the men that the elites were hoping to control. And so there's a marker of criminality placed on African-American men towards the end of the 19th century that is irrefutable. If you're a Black man, you're carrying inherently certain physical features that are considered to be criminal. And what we see is that that starts to filter into all different types of popular culture, all the way through to the late 20th century and into the 21st. And so when you are a police officer and you're in a community where you're dealing with African-Americans, or when you're outside of that community and you come into contact with an African-American man and definitely also women, those deeply entrenched understandings of race and their connection to criminality that stretch far back before that person, that police officer, was even born, are operating in his or her interactions with that African-American person. So these are deeply a part of our culture. They're entrenched in all of our psyches, and definitely some of us are more aware of them, and many others are obviously not.
I cast a documentary last year where I had to interview about 50 Black men. They were all rap artists, and we were looking for somebody to follow who had a really interesting story. So I had to sit with each of these amazing artists one at a time, and we would have very, very long conversations about their lives. And I asked them to just don't hold anything back. Just tell me about the biggest obstacles in your lives. Tell me about yourself. And they had to trust me to listen. And it was such an amazing opportunity that I'm so grateful for. And as I expected, 99% of them had very negative encounters with the police. And they were from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. Some had gone to USC, some had never gone to college. One guy had been pulled over for no reason. Police took him out of the car, and the policeman reached into his pants and grabbed his genitals in order to get a reaction out of him. He clearly wanted him to do something that would lead him to be arrested or something. And this guy just told me, I mean, this is like a 30-year-old man telling me this story with such shame and embarrassment and saying that he just had to take it. But another story that kept coming up was just indifference by the police to any crimes against their community. One boy came home from school. His grandmother had been raped and strangled and was dead on the floor. And he says that the police just did not investigate her murder. So just story after story like this, it was incredible, yet not shocking to hear.
If you are arresting and stopping people who are where many of them haven't done anything, you create a culture in that community, even a high crime community, where people feel like they are being criminalized.
Once again, as a historian, I always go back into the past. It's something that's very deeply entrenched in the history of policing. I mean, I'll say just to begin that we don't really start to see police departments until the mid 19th century. And when they do start to come together, they're usually just a ragtag bunch of men who are not wearing uniforms. They're kind of just enforcers on the street, almost like yet another gang. And they use a lot of violence, and they're not even investigating crimes, right? So we have to remember that policing began without investigation. As they become more formalized, you can see in the historical record, and I mentioned this in my book, that a lot of African-American communities felt a sense of indifference or anger and resentment towards the police, because not only did they not protect African-American communities, not only did they not very often, I'm talking about the period around the turn of the 20th century, not only did they not often protect those communities, but they also didn't investigate crimes. I have countless investigative reports. I have interviews of African-Americans from that period who talked about how there were a number of crimes against them that they felt were never even considered crimes by the police. But then on top of that, to make matters even worse, we see sprawling across the early 20th century, a number of instances where there is racial violence against African-American communities that police officers participated in. One very prominent one from New York history that I write about in my book is happens in 1900 when an African-American man is being assaulted by a police officer. He gets the better of the police officer and takes his life, and then he flees. And because of that death, a huge number of Irish immigrants kind of descend on the Black community. This is in central Manhattan around Midtown. And they start killing people and destroying homes, burning places down, and the police are participating. So there's this very long history of not only indifference, but hostility from police to Black communities, and vice versa, because of Black response to this general sense of unsafety. So, I mean, this is something that most African Americans, even today, have been touched by. It's something that we've seen many times over the course of our lifetimes, let alone deep into the past of our country. And it's something that the people in the streets are protesting right now. The people in the streets are not just protesting over the death of George Floyd, although that is enough of a reason to be in the streets, but they're also responding to this deep reservoir of intergenerational trauma that comes from not only, as you said, police neglect, but also from police violence.
Yeah, and Doug, it's really important, I think, for people to understand that despite that history, that many African-Americans have become police officers.
Yes.
They would have to have overcome all that historical distress to do this. And yet, in some people's minds, they now have become the enemy. One thing that I think we need to absolutely state unequivocally, police never have the authority to punish. It is not within their authority in any way, shape, or form in the United States of America. A police officer is never authorized to punish anyone. However, I do believe that they do all the time. And I do believe that is why George Floyd is now dead. Because although it emerged slowly over the days after George Floyd was killed, it appears that there was a period of time where the police officers had him in the police vehicle. Mm-hmm. And there was a struggle that went on. Mm-hmm. I don't know who started what or what happened, but or how he got out of that vehicle. But he did. And I don't know if they took him out or if he got out himself. But that is when he was then pinned to the ground with that officer's, well, that murderer's, because he's now no longer an officer and now he's charged with murder. So with that person's knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. And that, the look on his face, on that officer's face, while he was committing that crime, while people were videotaping him, while people were screaming and yelling and pleading for him to get off his neck, while his co-officer twice said, "We should roll him over. We should get him on his side," was one of, "I am going to show you, you cannot disrespect me. I am going to punish you. And I don't give a damn what the consequences are." I believe that that is something that we have to ingrain deeply in our police officers. One of many things, but that's a very important issue.
If I could say really quickly, just to agree with you, Jim, that I was one of the times when I was teaching my Politics of Black Criminality course, I actually had this conversation with my students. As I was on my way to work during one of my sessions about policing, I passed someone's house that had a sign up front that said, "We support the police." And presumably they were responding, because this was right in the middle of the Black Lives Matter protests of 2014 and 2015. They were responding to the Black Lives Matter protests, as many people have, with this idea that says Black Lives Matter protests don't understand what the value is in policing, right? That there are some good police. And the way that I felt like responding to that was to say, not, I didn't speak to the person in their home, but that the Black Lives Matter is not necessarily saying, maybe there are some people who are saying this, but it's not necessarily saying that we don't support the police. There are a lot of ways in which the police are necessary. There are a lot of ways in which the police, we all need the police. I think what the Black Lives Matter movement protesters are largely saying is that police need to be accountable also, just like other citizens need to be accountable. That police are necessary. Police are a part of our lives in a lot of ways. protect us. But they need to be accountable. And as you said, they can't be allowed to punish people. They can't be allowed to punish people in ways that might kill them. They can't be allowed to just simply respond in ways that are directed by their own fear that might take other people's lives and then not be accountable for what happens in the end. Anyone who works in a potato chip factory has to be accountable for the mistakes that they make, because those mistakes might take lives, and that police officers also need to be responsible. And I'll just add really quickly, I think my perspective on this is sharpened in a lot of ways by my father, who was a police officer for 20 years in New York City. And through the prism of my father's career and the conversations I had with him, I know that police officers can be great people because he was a great officer. I also know through him that police officers and policing itself can be corrupt, that there can be racism involved, that there can be all different types of ways in which the individuals who are humans themselves can be flawed, and that that can affect policing. I also know two more things: that police officers deal with trauma on a daily basis. And the fact that our country has this obsession with violence that makes it so that we have more, just as an example, more gun murders on our streets every year than a lot of other industrialized nations contributes to an emerging fear that police officers have to deal with, because they, just like anyone else, want to go home at the end of the day, back to their families. So they're dealing with trauma, they're dealing with violence, they're rushing into situations that we all run away from. And so that is something that also has to be taken into account. But also through my father, I realized that policing, especially when it goes bad, and especially when there is no accountability, creates that exact same trauma for the communities that they police.
Right.
And all of those things can be true at the same time.
Right. And one of the fundamental issues that creates a problem is that because policing is so dangerous, because of, let's say, the fact that there are more guns in the United States of America than people, that it becomes a life-threatening situation every time a police officer stops a car, because that is the number one most fatal incident that a police officer has. And I think domestic disturbance calls are the next most fatal. But the fact is that when police officers are going through trauma like that on a daily basis, and it is unaddressed, they respond by not only being fearful for their lives, but by drawing closer together to each other with their comrades. And they feel that their lives and the lives of their fellow officers are dependent upon them sticking together. And so you get the thin blue line. You get the impermeable line of defense of one police officer for the next, because they feel that they have this, they're this band of brothers and sisters who put their lives on the line, and so they feel they have to help each other, good or bad. And unfortunately, in police departments, at least in major cities, I know this to be true, that police departments in which someone calls out a bad cop or a cop who does bad activity is then seen as a rat, as a traitor, and not as a real police officer. And what that does is it engenders a fear on the part of anybody who would step in that they will lose their job, lose respect, lose their friends, and maybe lose their life. This is one of those insidious problems that also has to be addressed.
And it's sort of like what Laura says too, Jim, is that she says, you know, not all abusers are abusive all the time. If you have a partner who has racist tendencies, but they've had your back and they've saved your life, and you've seen them do very positive things, what is your, And when I think about people like your father, Dr. Flo, that's what gets me when I see ACAB written everywhere and fuck the police and all this. I understand it completely, but it hurts too, because I know so many great cops. I know so many cops that are internal affairs commanders and who have spent their careers trying to get dirty cops out of the system, and they're suffering too. They feel like, as you brought up, how Jim, how police officers are likely to get killed when they're disrupting a domestic violence call. And last month, a black female cop was killed responding to a domestic violence call. And where is the outrage for her death? So from their point of view, that's what they're saying.
Right.
I understand. And I think every issue that we ever deal with, very often we find ourselves speaking on either side of the issue, one extremity or the other. And as you can, there's a need for balance, right? I mean, pretty much every issue needs to find its way to the center and find a sense of balance.
The majority of the police officers that I know, we all want to see behavior that is improperly exhibited by a police officer criminalized. You have to do your job as a police officer. And then on the other hand, when you remove your uniform and badge and you go home, many of us spend our times in the Black community. The social organizations that we tend to become members of are Black, the fraternities, sororities, alumni associations. So we go from being police officers who work in a process where it's our duty to do what we were sworn to do, and that's uphold the laws. But then you have some very heinous things that happen. I will not compromise my convictions as an African-American male for the convenience of being a police officer. Just can't do it.
Now, I think a lot of the people who are speaking against the police, it's hard to have nuanced conversations in the media, in this, especially in a short snippet culture. But ultimately, part of that balance might come from rethinking policing, along with rethinking a lot of aspects of inequality in our society, right? Some of the inequality, and then also possibly gun control, can contribute to removing some of the reasons why police officers respond so forcefully, but also changing the lives of the people that are living in those communities who are feeling like they're under siege, right? I mean, the way that we do policing right now is to attack the symptoms of a problem once it becomes impossible to ignore. Mm-hmm. Once a crime is committed, then police come to clean up the mess. Very often they do so in forceful ways, which can turn to violence, especially with people who are tense and concerned about their own lives.
Yeah.
But then, so what if we were to think about policing in some of the same ways that we should be thinking about healthcare, right? Right now, our healthcare system is very often about dealing with problems and not dealing with the symptoms of problems and not necessarily working on the underlying cause before they turn into a problem, right? Once a disease is unavoidable, we work on it rather than preventing it. And here we can think of crime or the sorts of underground economies that circulate in certain communities that lead to other types of more serious crime as a symptom that ends up being attacked rather than the inequality at the base. The underlying causes of the sickness are never treated. And so I think that there are many complex issues, as you've been saying, that need to be dealt with, but they need to be dealt with in tandem, right?
Right.
It's like whack-a-mole, right? You can't really get one part of this problem to go down unless you address the other part of the problem at the same time.
Right. I really wish Laura was here because Laura actually headed up UK's first homicide prevention unit in New Scotland Yard. I mean, they actually were trying to do that. I've told her many times, I wish we could do that here. Why are we only reactive as a police force? Why aren't we using our and even big data and minutia details about individuals who have demonstrated a violent past or who are at risk? Why aren't we addressing those people and trying to prevent crime rather than being there to come down and crush them after they have committed crimes? And another related issue is the use of aggression in interactions, law enforcement interactions. And I hope we can talk about a particular incident of this Providence firefighter that has just recently hit the news. But I do not believe that aggression is necessary on the part of law enforcement officers when they interact with the public. In fact, I believe it is counterproductive. It is actually very destructive, and it leads to an escalation of violence. I, as you said earlier, Lisa, in your interview, this gentleman told you that as a Black man, he just has to take it. He was sexually assaulted by a police officer in order to get a reaction. I know that my friend Tony had a similar response where an officer tried to shove him on a stairway so that he would then respond back. Luckily, where he shoved him was his arm that was deadened in an accident. He doesn't have a reflex in it. And so he didn't respond. But the cop had already, they were having a discussion. He handed him his business license. They were walking back up the stairs. The cop had his gun out and was pointing it at his head when he shoved him with his other hand. He was clearly trying to set up a situation where he could kill my friend. Luckily, his brother took that moment to walk down the stairs and Tony wasn't killed. And those kinds of incidents are clearly, they're obviously just the tip of the iceberg of a major underlying problem. Last week when we had on Professor James Densley, he's from the UK, and he said in the UK, we police by consent. In the United States, you police by force. And that seems to me, Doug, you're very insightful about the history. I didn't know that about how policing began in the United States of America. I actually thought it had been a branch off of the military. But when you tell me now that it was, you know, these sort of enforcer gangs that were put together and then were, quote, legitimized over time, if their introduction into society was a violent one, it makes sense that in this country, at least, they continue that over the course of the next couple of centuries.
Yeah, and let me just say really quickly about, just to add to that really quickly, police violence was a thing that everyone was concerned about at the end of the 19th century. Looking at New York City in particular, in 1896, I think it was, you have the Lexow Committee hearings. A lot of police would walk down the street beating people up, everyone. Upper class people, working class people, white, black, they beat everyone up. That was their way of organizing people in the public and enforcing their sense of authority. And with the Lexow Committee, with that committee, you see that upper class elite white New Yorkers are saying this has got to stop. And this becomes a bifurcation point where it becomes racialized afterwards. After this committee gets the conviction of a few police officers start to just beat up working class and black people because they don't want to have to deal with this that same sort of investigation again. I also wanted to say really quickly about what you said about the UK. I've watched some British police shows and been amazed by how you see some police officers walking around and going in and investigating. Obviously, it's a TV show, but they're investigating without guns.
Oh yeah, just the stick. Yeah,
they just have a stick, or it might be a detective, and they're not carrying a weapon, and they arrive at a scene, and they have to fight with some person, right? And this is a TV show, but could you imagine a TV show like that in America? Americans would just completely disbelieve the premise, and that's because there's so much of an expectation of violence and as a part of policing that even in our popular thoughts or in our imagination, we couldn't see it without guns.
But as the vision maybe of a new police is changing. There's this book, The End of Policing, mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you've heard of. It's that we're trying to have police do too many things at the same time. They have to be social workers. Yeah. They have to be this. They have to be that. And taking some of that away from their responsibility could be much more healthy for them. Would you agree?
Well, that's a really interesting point. Yeah, I think a lot of the people, again, we see these abolished police signs and I think there's more nuance behind them, which would mean, as you were saying, possibly diverting some of the resources that go towards policing now, which were ramped up, by the way, in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, to the point where police roll through communities like they're a branch of the military, kind of pulling some of those resources back, some of the resources that are used to lock up petty drug offenders, for instance, and divert them towards programs that are meant to improve the lives of people who find themselves in situations where they might be on the opposite end of the legal schema from the police, right? Improving communities, and not simply improving them by creating gardens or by putting community centers into them, but finding ways to systemically change the economic plight of these communities. A lot of the African-American communities and cities are still reeling from the urban crisis of the 1960s, the deindustrialization, and in all of the different ways that their communities were changed and destroyed by urban renewal. They're still reeling from the change in the economic structure that we've seen over the past 50 years. matters, and it means improving those things, changing them for the better, not simply doing window dressing, but changing the structure that produces criminality, and then policing in a way that is more about peacekeeping. Obviously, it can't always be about police keeping. Obviously, there are going to be these pinch point moments where police need to respond with force. But those moments should be very different, and they should also be greatly reduced.
I think it's important for us to make a statement that, of course, we do not condone. In fact, we condemn violence against police officers, violence against any human being.
Definitely.
And the only reason for using force is to protect, not to be aggressive, not to take advantage, not to hurt others. And we do support police departments across this country and around the world, particularly because we know. I mean, I spent 22 years in the FBI, and before that I was in the prosecutor's office, and Laura also worked for New Scotland Yard for many years. We both in our professional careers have been working hand in hand with police officers and other related professionals to help people, to stop crime, to stop the people that would do harm to others, in support of victims throughout our whole careers. And that can't be done in the world today without police departments and police officers. So we want to tell people that we do support the police. We don't believe police should be defunded, but at the same time, we also understand that there have been ingrained in the system, and thank you for helping us understand the genesis of that, the foundation of that, Doug. And I hope we can continue this discussion about maybe some specific cases where we can actually break down what happened and why. And then also look at both sides of the equation, because I think there's a lot of information out there that people kind of gloss over and don't actually see the root cause. And unless we know the root cause, we won't be able to stop it, at least in my opinion. Doug, can you please tell us about the book you recently published and about the book you're working on?
Yes, the book that I recently published is called Uncontrollable Blackness, African American Men and Criminality in New York City. I start the book off with a quote that is meant to really kind of encapsulate what it's about. It's a quote from Maladoma Patrice Somme, the writer of a book called Of Water and the Spirit. And he says, "There are times when disobedience heals a very ailing part of the self. It relieves the human spirit's distress at being forced into narrow boundaries. For the nearly powerless, defying authority is often the only power available." And so what I've done in my book is I've tried to take the stories of African-American men, working-class men in New York City, as representative of the rest of the country at the time. And we're looking at the time between 1890 and 1920. Understand what sorts of factors may have existed in their lives that may have either made them commit crimes or may have put them in positions where others criminalized their behaviors. And so this is not in any way to say that Black men were any more likely to commit crimes than anyone else, but it is to say, let's look at the lives of the people who were entangled with the law and what is happening around them that in some ways kind of pushes their behaviors into certain directions. My next book is tentatively titled at the moment, Prison, Power, and Protest, African Americans and New York's Interwar Carceral State. And what I'm doing is I'm attempting to bridge the historical gap between early 20th century imprisonment, which has been written about as convict labor, convict leasing, and other forms of incarceration, and late 20th century mass incarceration. There's a gap in there that hasn't really been filled, where I'm attempting to make an argument that there is a moment where we can see different types of state institutions attempting to control African Americans in a way that ends up reaching into their social, economic, and gendered lives to create this kind of full carceral reality. Right, taking the imperatives of imprisonment and injecting it to some extent into the outside world in order to police certain communities.
Wow.
That's great. That's a lot to, you know, take on.
Yeah.
Yes, but thank you so much. So, Doug, this has been so great talking to you. And thank you so much for being so comprehensive in how you're dealing with the issues that led to the death of George Floyd and the protests that have now sprung out of that.
Yeah, it's been such an honor to meet you, Dr. Flo, which is just the coolest name. I'm sorry. I just have to keep saying it. Not only for your work, but also as somebody who knew a little Jimmy Clementi. I want to know more stories about that.
I'm sorry, Lisa, but we don't have enough time.
Oh, darn. Okay. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Great. And so when we come back next week, we'll continue our discussion on the horrific events that led to the death of George Floyd and so many other people like him when we continue our discussion with Dr. Flo. So till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233. Yeah.